Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We are here to help you learn and improve your American English. At the same time, you will learn about interesting and important things happening all around us. Today's program is all about sound, a special kind of music from America's West Coast, and then sound or noise in our forests. You are going to like this one. So let's get started with Anna Mateo.
People are scared of you guys. You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
The music genre, known as gangster or gangsta rap, was born in the poor, dangerous neighborhood of Compton in Los Angeles, California. The violence of street life there and tense relations between the community and police influenced the sound. The music expressed the anger and distrust of the community. Movie director F. Gary Gray explores that world through the story of N.W.A., the band that revolutionized rap in the 1980s.
You have a unique voice. The world needs to hear it.
They want N.W.A.? Let's give them N.W.A.
One of the band members, O'Shea Jackson, grew up in Compton. He wrote songs on the school bus that reflected his experiences. He later took the stage name Ice Cube. Ice Cube wrote one song about the gangster who got on his school bus and put a gun to a classmate's head. He also wrote about the police who handcuffed him and threatened his parents because he happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Where do you think you're going?
And I'm just trying to get home.
That's my son!
You need to get back in the house or I will ruin your night.
Mr. Gray's film shows Ice Cube teaming up with his friends. Dre, an expert in music production, Eazy-E, a charismatic performer, as well as MC Run and DJ Yella. They created the rap group N.W.A. and rapped about drugs, sex, violence, and poverty.
You're listening to Compton's very own Ice Cube, Eazy-E, and Dr. Dre. I gotta tell you, you are witnessing history.
F. Gary Gray said he worked hard to keep the story as real as possible, including filming in Compton.
This is not only history, it's American history, it's world history. And so I get a chance to put on my journalist hat and be a historian.
Ice Cube is one of the film's producers. He remembers those times.
Our music was like our weapon,
and that's the most powerful weapon we got.
He said the band did not use guns to fight back. Instead, they used a microphone. In his words, at the end of the day, we're still artists. Ice Cube's son, O'Shea Jackson Jr., portrays him as a young man in the film. Thinking about his father's music, the younger Jackson said, they talked about the things others were scared to talk about and shed light on the things that people needed to know. Straight Outta Compton has received mostly positive reviews from movie critics. However, some have argued that the film fails to address reports of abusive treatment of women by N.W.A. members. But N.W.A.'s music caused severe public reaction outside of Compton. The media sharply criticized the group. The police had N.W.A.'s members under watch. The band even received a letter from the FBI. The letter asked the group to remove song lyrics that included threatening language directed at the police.
Your songs, they glamorize gangs and drugs.
Our art is a reflection of our reality.
In one scene in the film, Ice Cube speaks at a press conference about the group's constitutional right to free speech. But his words were not especially helpful to the cause. NWA members were repeatedly arrested and beaten up by police and by gangsters. The film centers on NWA's rise to fame and the relationships among its members. It suggests that money and fame damaged those friendships and led to the breakup of the group. The film's depictions of police violence are especially powerful, coming after the police killings of unarmed black men such as Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City. The film had a very successful opening weekend. It made more than $56 million in ticket sales in the United States last weekend. Industry experts are expecting the film to continue to attract big audiences this weekend. I'm Ana Mateo.
That was fun. Thanks, Anna. Now, something about noise outdoors and its effects on our animal friends. Biologists from Boise State University have been making noise in the forests of the western American state of Idaho. They are making noise to study the value of quiet in nature. They want to know how people and animals react to noise pollution. The researchers placed outdoor speakers on the side of a half-kilometer-long part of a road in the Boise National Forest. For 2 years, they played the sounds of passing cars through the speakers. Professor Jesse Barber of Boise State University says they found the sounds caused migratory birds to flee. The birds also failed to gain weight. Recently, researchers played sounds of machines that are used to remove natural gas from the ground. That sound is heard in natural gas fields throughout the American West. Professor Barber says these experiments are designed to help researchers learn the effects of noise pollution on birds, insects, bats, plants, and people.
We're testing the idea that these things are coupled, that as the soundscape gets louder, wildlife suffers, but that also feeds back onto how much people get out of that experience, how much they value it, and thus how much they're willing to protect that same place.
The research team also studied a group of volunteers who watch birds for fun. Mitch Levenhagen is a graduate student in the research team. He measured how much the artificial noise lessened the ability of the bird watchers to identify recorded bird songs. He recorded 8 songs in the noise condition and 8 songs in the quiet. He then repeated the experiment without the artificial noise. The bird watchers were happy when the noise machine was shut off.
Yay!
The bird watchers said the artificial noise affected their ability to identify bird sounds more than they thought it would. Bird watcher Jim Lyon said the experiment caused him to value quiet more.
I just think the whole thing has been ear-opening, shall we say, to be part of this. Very stimulating, very interesting, and going to think a lot about it, I know, from now on.
Volunteer Janice Engel said she, too, likes the quiet.
I moved out of the city to, I bought a little place in the country where I wanted it to be quiet. I greatly value that. It's hard to find those places more and more. There are lots of ways to mitigate sound, but it's a trade-off. There's always a cost, and it comes down to people's values. What do we value more?
The National Park Service is paying for some noise pollution research. The federal agency is also examining other ways to reduce noise. They include putting new surfaces on roads, and they are creating quiet areas with signs telling visitors to turn off their mobile phones. Next year, Mr. Levenhagen and Professor Barber will go to Northern California to ask visitors at Muir Woods National Monument and other parks how they feel about noise. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
For VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report.
Recent killings by police officers have raised tensions in some American communities. The Washington Post newspaper reported that police officers have killed 24 unarmed black men in the past year. These deaths have led to anti-police demonstrations in several U.S. cities. The Maryland National Capitol Park Police is reaching out to young people with a program called Cops Camp for Kids. The program started in 1998 as a way to bring the police and the community together in a positive environment. Lakeisha Robinson helps run Cops Camp for Kids. She has been a police officer for 9 years.
A lot of children, they grow up in neighborhoods where they only see negative. I want them to see that we're not all just got out here to lock everyone up. We're here to mentor. We're here to be a listening ear, because believe it or not, some of the kids don't have that.
About 40 children from 9 to 12 years old joined the program this year. They are learning about what it's like to be a police officer or cop. Police officer Randy Green showed his shiny black motorcycle to the children. They formed a circle around him. They asked questions about his job. The children watched in amazement as the police officer drove his motorcycle through an obstacle course. The children also got to learn about police horses. A police officer explained how to take care of the horses. She showed how the police train horses to ignore noises and other distractions. Afterward, the children got to ride on one of the police horses. The young people also went on a series of special field trips. They visited a Secret Service training center. The Secret Service is the agency that protects President Obama and his family. The campers learned about espionage on a visit to the Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. The police also took the children to a courthouse to watch a real trial. There was also time for more usual camp activities, swimming, bowling, and laser tag. But for many campers, it was the police activities that make them want to return. 11-year-old Kaya Abui attended Cops Camp for the second year.
I think it's a really good idea to have the officers connect with the kids and give them kind of the insight on their job and what they do, so we know why they're protecting us and how much they love their job.
Officer Lakeisha Robinson says each camper shows that Cops Camp for Kids is a success.
And even now we have so many repeat campers that come back every year. And I just love it. It warms my heart because it's telling me that I'm actually making a difference.
We are Cops Camp!
I'm Ann Ball.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we begin the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was one of the country's founding fathers. He never became president. He did, however, become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. At that time, the American government was very weak. It had many debts and no money. Many of the country's citizens did not support their own government. Many wondered if America would last. In a few years, however, there was a change. This change was produced in large part by the energy and imagination of one man, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton wanted to make America a strong and important nation. He wanted it to become the equal of the powerful nations of Europe. There is much mystery about the early days of Alexander Hamilton. Some facts about his childhood and youth have been clearly established. Others have not. Historians think he was born around 1755 or 1757. His mother was the daughter of French Huguenots who had settled in the British West Indies. Her name was Rachel Lavien. Historians are not sure who his father was. One story says he may have been James Hamilton, a poor businessman from Scotland. Rachel Lavien lived with him after she left her husband. One thing is certain. His mother died when he was 11 years old. When she died, friends of the family found work for the boy on the island of St. Croix, then called Santa Cruz, in the Virgin Islands. He became an assistant bookkeeper and learned how to keep financial records. Young Alexander was not like the other children. Other children played games. He talked about becoming a political leader in the North American colonies. He read every book that was given to him in English, French, Latin, and Greek. At a young age, he learned a great deal about business and economics, and he developed an ability to communicate ideas clearly and powerfully.
He showed great talents as a writer, very observant, and gained notice when he wrote an account of a local hurricane, which was picked up by the local press.
Valerie Paley is a historian at the New York Historical Society. She says Hamilton's writing was so good that his boss and some other people decided to help him get a good education. They gave him money so he could attend a college in New York City. The boy's plan was to study medicine and return to St. Croix as a doctor. But he never lived in the West Indies again. At King's College in New York City, both teachers and students were surprised by Hamilton's intelligence and clear way of communicating. He often expressed his thinking about the problems of the American colonies. Hamilton was against British rule. He wrote a paper defending the colonists in the city of Boston who seized a British ship and threw its cargo of tea into the water. The protest over taxes became known as the Boston Tea Party. Valerie Paley of the New York Historical Society says Hamilton's upbringing may have influenced his views.
Some historians have argued that he was somewhat stateless. He was adrift. He was his own man. And in a way, there was something so passionately right for Hamilton in joining something as apparently important as a revolutionary cause.
The year 1776 arrived. The 13 American colonies declared their independence from Britain. The declaration meant war. The American Revolution gave Hamilton the chance to show his abilities. He became part of a New York militia and fought in some important early battles. It was not long before Hamilton met the commander-in-chief of American forces, George Washington. General Washington recognized Hamilton's talents. He promoted Hamilton and invited him to become an aide. In that job, Hamilton wrote letters and reports for Washington. Hamilton had to use all his political and communication skills to get money and supplies for the Revolutionary Army. He asked the 13 state governments. He also asked the Congress, which had little political power at that time. He got almost no help from either. Hamilton came to believe firmly that the American system of government was too weak and disorganized. Even so, historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton became one of the most important people on George Washington's staff.
Hamilton had never had a father, of course, that he knew or knew well, so there was something very, very loyal and very, very trusting about the relationship between the men. So I think it was something that was extremely important and influential to Hamilton's growth as a politician and as a thinker.
She says their relationship was almost like a father and son. But that did not mean their relationship was always good. Alexander Hamilton was a proud man. He was quick to criticize others. He even criticized George Washington. Once, during the war, Hamilton was late to a meeting with the general. Washington protested. Hamilton resigned. For the next 8 years, Hamilton was very busy. He led troops in some of the last battles of the American Revolution. He became a lawyer. He founded the Bank of New York, one of the very first banks in the country. He helped save his old school, King's College, and turn it into what is now Columbia University. He was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He wrote some of the Federalist Papers, among the most famous documents in American history. Hamilton's defense of a strong central government persuaded many Americans to ratify the Constitution and establish a new system of government. Historian Valerie Paley says Hamilton had a visionary way of thinking about the world.
He thought up, some would argue, the whole notion of what modern America is in terms of the way government works, in terms of finance, banking. He saw the importance of certain structures we take for granted before they even existed.
All Hamilton needed was a way to make his ideas happen. George Washington gave Hamilton that power. When Washington became president, he forgot their disagreement during the war. He asked his former aide to become the country's first Secretary of the Treasury. The job would be difficult.
The United States at that time was a financial basket case.
Business historian John Steele Gordon wrote a book about Hamilton.
There was no real money supply. In the colonial days, they had used a hodgepodge of coins from British and Spanish and Portuguese and what have you. It's a very chaotic system.
In other words, there was no such thing yet as American money. John Steele Gordon says America also had to borrow heavily to pay for the Revolutionary War. The new nation was deeply in debt. It had to find ways to bring in money and pay what it owed. One way to get money was to borrow it. But no one wanted to lend money to the United States unless they were sure they would get it back. So the Congress asked Treasury Secretary Hamilton to write a report about how to build up the government's credit. Hamilton's report said the government must pay back the full amount of all its debts. This caused a dispute. Many of the debts were in the form of government notes. The notes promised to pay someone for supplying food, clothing, and weapons to the rebel army. Some promised to pay soldiers for joining the army. The notes, however, were really worth nothing. The wartime Congress had no money. People who got them lost hope of ever getting repaid. So they sold them to anyone willing to pay even part of the value. Hamilton's plan would repay the full value of the notes to those who owned them last. Hamilton believed that those who bought the notes had a right to earn money from them. He said these men took a chance that the worthless notes would be worth something someday. Congressman James Madison of Virginia protested. He said the people who bought the notes at low cost should be paid, but not in full. Some of the money, he said, should go to those who got the notes in exchange for supplies or services. Madison made an emotional speech in Congress. He described the situation of former soldiers forced by hunger to sell their government notes for almost nothing. He noted that the Union was established to protect the people against such injustice. Hamilton answered that the purpose of his plan was greater than simply paying debts. He said it was a way to build up the nation's credit so it could borrow money more easily in the future. Many members of Congress felt sorry for the poor soldiers and their families. Yet, they voted against Madison's proposal and supported Hamilton's plan. Still, to win support for his plan, Hamilton had to make a political deal with several congressmen. They would support his financial plan, but he had to use his influence to get the capital of the United States moved. At that time, the Capitol was in the north, in New York City. Two congressmen from Virginia wanted it in the south, near their homes along the Potomac River. Several congressmen from Pennsylvania agreed, but they said the Capitol must first be moved to the city of Philadelphia in their state, and it must remain there for 10 years. Congress accepted this plan by a close vote. President Washington signed it into law. Hamilton was still a young man in his 30s, but he had already succeeded in remaking the country's economic policies, and he had established the country's permanent capital in Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. He had also made some enemies. His next plan would create even more. That will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.